Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
It is Tour Live. You've got to leave a little gap because of YouTube so that it all connects up. That was what I was doing there. It is a pleasure to be here with you on this Wednesday. Wednesday, you say? Why Wednesday? Well, it's because people are making their way towards the Champions League final. We want to get it done. We want to get it boxed off. That chat is on its way to you towards the end of this live and this podcast. We've got some work coming as well. Some fantastic stuff will be making its way around John Gibbons, who's been speaking to the OLSC in Paris, Camilla there, and some on the manifesto film done by Daniel Draper. That is to come. But today, the Anfield Wrap has decided it will be Divock Origi Day because of everything that the big man has done for us down the year. Well, I'll ask you all for your favourite moments. I've got Emma Sanders, Ian Ryan and Adam Smith. But it is the most unique Liverpool career I can think of, Ian Ryan. Growing up, there was always a lot of chat around David Fairclough. David Fairclough because of his brilliance against St Etienne and the fact that he had, you know, three or four genuinely excellent seasons with Liverpool. Divock is like David Fairclough times 10. It is the most remarkable Liverpool career. It really is. I struggle to put it into words when I stop to think about it.
Yeah, it is. It is completely remarkable. And I think, you know, I was looking at some of the stats that kind of sit behind kind of Rigi's Liverpool career, and I think it's 41 goals in total across the kind of what is it now, 7 years. I think just over half of those come in the league, but that's probably doing it a little bit of disservice to kind of frame it in those terms, because
absolutely
it's the nature of the goals, it's the quality of them as well. It's not just the big moments where he scored really, really important goals. There's so many in there that are just outstanding in terms of a quality finish. And I think sometimes you can try and be a little bit clever about, you know, if you're going to pick a personal favourite or, you know, whatever it may be, and you cannot underplay last-minute winners in derby matches, for instance. But when you are scoring goals in Champions League semi-finals that ultimately bring Anfield its greatest ever night in the history of the club. And I refuse to kind of to hear any difference on that. You know, some people will have a different view and they'll talk about St Etienne. They might talk about, you know, even Inter Milan in 65 or Chelsea in 05. That Barcelona comeback, which is started by him in the 7th minute, that's when everyone in the crowd turned to each other and went, it's on. It's absolutely on. And that's all because he is Johnny on the spot. He's in the right place, takes his opportunity, knows where to be. He's a proper centre forward. He's a proper number nine. And then you can get into what he does later on in the game, which is just ridiculous in terms of a quality finish. And then what he goes and does in the final, which is secure Liverpool another European Cup. He goes with our best wishes, Neil. He's had one hell of an impact on this football club. Given that he's only made probably just over 100 league appearances, around about 175 appearances in total. But my God, what a player he's been for this football club.
In amongst many strange things, Emma, he disappears off to Wolfsburg for a season on loan. That happens. That's in his career as well. He obviously doesn't come when he's first signed. He, at this point, still, you know, he's still only 26, I think, right now as well. There's a lot of career left for him. And yet, the bulk of it, and the bulk of his biggest contributions in football will have come at Liverpool. These are enormous contributions. So I've got one for you before we do the moment. I've got one for all of you. He scores two against Arsenal in that mad 5-5. He scores the goal that makes it 4-4 and then the goal that makes it 5-5. And then he scores a pen in the shootout. And that was just a really weird wild night at Anfield, and there is Divock to add his own touch to it, Emma. You know, it is just a remarkable set of goals, of moments that he's produced.
Yeah, when you said he was still only 26, I was like, 26? I mean, that in itself is mad, because the things that he's achieved at this football club, and, you know, we're talking about Liverpool here. This is a club that has got historic players, historic moments. Some players go throughout their entire careers not even having any of those moments for a club like Liverpool. And he's done it 5, 6, 7 times, you know, and he's done this all before the age of 26. So it's absolutely remarkable what he's managed to achieve at that age and in such a long career at one of the biggest clubs in the world. And yeah, you know, we speak about those moments, but Ian said it, it's not just the fact that he's popped up in a Champions League final, in a Champions League semi-final, in countless Merseyside derbies. It's the fact that he's done it with class as well, and with moments of quality. You know, it's not, yes, there's a classic Jordan Pickford derby goal, which everyone knows about, which is your typical Divock Origi scrappy goal. But then there's also those moments of sheer quality as well. You know, even the corner taken quickly goal, Trent gets all the credit for it, and rightly so. But actually, you look at the reactions from Origi and the way that he manages to turn his body and direct that goal. That is still quality. And that, you know, I think that's something which people sometimes forget about Divock Origi, is that he's a very, very good footballer, and he will be a very good footballer at another club. And I'm sure he's got plenty of big moments to come. But yeah, as Ian said, I mean, he leaves with all of our best wishes. And what a guy, what a guy.
It is so many of those big moments, crunch times. Adam Smith, he scored his variety of goals. He scored 3 against Wolves, 3 against Southampton, 3 against Arsenal, 3 against West Ham, 2 against Arsenal, 2 against Norwich, etc., etc. I could go on. The point of this is he scored 6 against Everton. And, you know, that again has felt like a thing. The worst thing that happens to him in his career, arguably so far for Liverpool, other than that season at Wolfsburg, which feels as though it was deeply unpleasant, the worst thing that happens to him for his career so far has been the injury against Everton. And yet, my God, he has had his revenge on them.
Yeah, I think, was it you that said, I can't remember, is it a show or off, you know, out of the show, but I'm not saying anything that you'll be annoyed as public. I think you said that, you know, you had a theory that Funes Mori was a time traveller come back to stop Divock Origi doing what he was going to do to them in the future, which I think is a really great way of thinking about it, because he's just, like, he's absolutely terrorised them. Like, for, you know, if you consider, like, obviously, Rush will always and forever go down in the record books, you know, for what he did to Everton. But Divock Origi has just done it every single time. And, you know, I think the Anfield Rap accounts tweeted before, of course his last goal for the club was against Everton. Of course it was, you know. And actually, I always thought that this was... I said to Stu Wright when I saw him a while ago, I was convinced that Everton would go down this season because we knew Divock Origi was leaving. Almost like he was going, well, my work's done, so I'll see you all later. Like, he just seems to have taken it really personally that they exist. And, you know, who can't get behind that as a theory?
I mean, this is a, you know, it is a massive part of this. The other part of this as well, Ian, is of all of his goals, he scored 15 of them. They're all come from open play playing for Liverpool, and he scored 15 of them. 15 of them in the last 15 minutes of matches. You know, that is, again, this the calm he's got. I think it could go really well for him at AC Milan, and we obviously all hope that it does, if that is indeed where he ends up. One of the reasons why is he's got all this big experience, this big game experience. But I think the other thing that he's shown all the way through is remarkable temperament in key moments. And that's why I think there's every chance that, you know, that AC Milan may be getting, if it is them, and as I say, I do hope it is, and maybe getting a slightly better player, a slightly more well-rounded player than they might expect, but also a player who you can call upon when you need him, a player who will be there when it's required to do the decent thing.
Yeah, when you talk about, you know, temperament and stuff and the ability to remain calm in big moments, you know, that goal against Barcelona, the second one, which Emma kind of talked about in terms of Trent gets a lot of the credit, understandably so, to remain as calm as that and to finish it the way he does, it's such an underrated finish. There's very few people, I think, in the ground that night, I'm talking about players here, who can take that as well as he takes that in that moment with all the pressure that surrounds that. You know, Liverpool just got back into the game and it's just a huge moment, and he just takes it with just such calmness. And as I say, he's got that ability to do that. And I hope he does end up at somewhere like AC Milan, you know, recently crowned Italian champions. You know, they have got a couple of aging forwards there in Ibrahimovic and Giroud, who have contributed this season but are coming towards the end of their careers, you would think. So it does kind of make sense if it's somewhere like that. And I think, you know, I described Origi before. I said, you know, what a player he's been for this club. And he has, in terms of those moments. I think sometimes, if we're being really honest, there's times where you maybe wouldn't want to see him starting games because the way Liverpool play, it would then maybe stutter a little bit when it got to him because he's a different type of footballer. But that doesn't mean there's not a place for a Didier Origi somewhere where he can add loads and loads of value, still score big goals, still be a headline maker, and still have one hell of a career. And the fact that he is still only 26 is... it's a bit mind-blowing, to be honest, because it does feel like he's been around for ages. So all that, all what I've said there, contributes to him being not only a fantastic footballer, but also, you know, he's been a fantastic man for the club and for the city with the stuff that he's done outside of football. We'll be sad to see him go, Neil, but it's probably the right thing because he doesn't deserve just to be getting minutes here and there. He deserves to be someone who contributes a lot more. And I feel he can do that, given the right platform and the right stage.
He scored big goals for the manager, Emma. And what I mean on this is we sort of, because he was bought under Rodgers, he's not bought by Jurgen Klopp. But for instance, the goal where the manager takes the players to the Kop in the December of 2015 against West Bromwich Albion, the deflected goal, the 97th minute goal, is Divock Origi's goal. Origi scores on both legs later in the season against Borussia Dortmund. He scores against Everton in that big 4-0, and that's where he gets the injury. Even the year after, he scores a big goal against Sunderland as we're pushing to get Champions League qualification, even though he's not very much involved. You know, you can sort of go on through this, and then you've got the 18-19 run where he only gets 7 goals over the course of the season, but there's only really 2 of them that don't feel like, you know, there's only a goal against Wolves and a goal against Watford that don't feel epoch defining. Everton, Newcastle, a Barcelona brace, and Tottenham. He's been with, it's mad, isn't it? You know, he's been with the manager through all of these moments in all of these ways, all of these like life-defining things for the Liverpool manager, I'd say, career-defining things. Divock Origi has been there to help him out when he's needed him.
Yeah, you know what? It's actually an interesting point because I hadn't really thought about the fact that, you know, he came under Brendan Rodgers, because when you sit down and think about it, there's not many players in world football, certainly, that would be happy to be part of a squad for as long as Origi has and be, you know, fourth, fifth choice, really, behind that front three. And as, you know, as Ian says, a very, very different type of footballer to the one that Jurgen Klopp quite obviously wants to play with. So, you know, you look at someone like Divock Origi and a manager like Jurgen Klopp and think, how are the two so aligned? But as you say, he's won him over, essentially, with those big moments and those big goals. And Jurgen Klopp knows that, look, if he needs to go to plan B, plan C, whatever plan it is, to get that crucial goal, to bring someone on to make a difference in the last 10, 15 minutes, to keep their cool, to come up with those moments of quality, Origi showed him within the first 6 months of his Liverpool career that he was the guy that Klopp could turn to for that. And I think that's so invaluable. And that's something, as like I say, not many footballers can give. And I think that's something that Origi, wherever he goes next, he almost doesn't have to prove that to the next manager, because they've seen it countless times. You know, it's not just like he's done it for one manager in a small club. He's done it on the biggest stages in club football for over 7 years now, for one of the biggest managers in club football. So, you know, if you can get someone like Jurgen Klopp to trust you in a squad where there's Roberto Firmino, Diogo Jota, Luis Diaz, Mohamed Salah, Sadio Mane, the list goes on, then yeah, anyone can trust you.
Anyone indeed can. Adam, last word for you on the man himself. Well, I'll ask you all to just to nominate your favourite, just your favourite Divock Origi goal and moment. I think Ian's going to very much commit to those Champions League ones. What are you going for, Adam?
Yeah, well, mine's the Champions League final. And the reason why is because I think it was the moment where I got a bit of enlightenment over Origi, because I think I was kind of done with him. I was done with him a couple of seasons ago, to be honest with you. And I think that when I've sat and thought about it, I've thought, actually, he's not the player I want him to be. So I agree with what Ian said before, that I think a lot of the time he'll sort of, the attacks will slow down with him, the attacks will die with him when he's kind of asked to play in the way that Salah and Mane, etc., can play. That's not who he is. Who he is a player who who doesn't let the big occasion get to him. And he stank the place out in that Champions League final. Let's make no mistake. He was abysmal. I don't think he completed a pass. He barely had a touch. He was woeful. But it just didn't matter to him. I think if Salah had come on and done what Origi had done, I don't think Salah gets the goal that Origi gets, because I think he's two in his own head. Whereas Divock Origi is just a player who goes, well, that's all gone. Doesn't matter. That's happened now. It's fine. And he lets it go. And I think that Champions League final goal is the perfect summation of who he is as a person, as a player, that he's just able to, on the biggest of occasions, when everyone else is really tense, just able to go, well, I'll just score and then that'll sort it all out. And that's a quality that not a lot of players have, even the very best in the world, and it makes a big difference. So for me, that's the one.
Ian?
I mean, I think the Champions League final goal is probably, for me, the right answer, but I will just kind of give a nod to that first one against Barcelona, because that's the one that made the impossible seem possible. So it's such a significant goal. So yeah, I'll go with that.
Okay. Emma?
Yeah, I have to go with the Barcelona one, just because I think that's, you know, that's the greatest match in Liverpool's history in my lifetime. So for him to play such a key role in that, that has to be the one for me. But, you know, I'm sat here drinking a cup of tea out of my mug, which has got the sort of the BBC CFAX version of the Champions League final. And I can just see his name there. And I'm thinking, that's mad that, you know, a player who's come on and scored in the Champions League final, that doesn't even make my number one.
It is indeed the way in which it is. Listen, it is fantastic. Loads of stuff on the Anfield Wrap about Divock today. Do check it all out there all the way through. He's been phenomenal for us. He really has. In the run-up to another Champions League final that Liverpool are going to, Divock scored on this in this campaign as well. Got one earlier in the season against AC Milan, a belter too. Coming up, if you listen to this as a podcast, there is Daniel Draper, the director of a film called Manifesto, much of which is filmed in Walton with John Gibbons. That is to come. And also, we have got Camilla from the official Paris Supporters Club to speak to John as well. Loads of fantastic stuff happening in Paris. We'll see you on Friday night. And now we can obviously confirm that there will be a fan park, which will be free for people to enter. We'll be part of that early on in the day, I hasten to add. Just getting everyone in the mood, getting everyone ready for it. There's some brilliant stuff on there. There really is. Loads of big ideas as well. Loads of ambition. So if you're in Paris, do make your way over to that. Anyway, this is the Anfield Wrap, and this is the bit of Tour Live where we go from part one all the way through to part four, and it has happened now.
It's John Gibbons for Tour Live, and I'm joined now in the studio by Daniel Draper, who's a director from the city, who we've spoken to before about your last project, Dan, but now you've got something new coming up as well.
Yeah, John, yeah, new film out next month called Manifesto, which is a feature-length documentary about Walton Constituency Labour Party, which we spent 3 years shooting. And it's all done there now, ready to sort of release to the world, if you like.
I mean, 3 years is a long time, first of all. Was there a reason you sort of wanted to film over such a long period?
That was never the plan, really. I think we thought it'd be about a year. We started in the summer of 2019 with the idea that, you know, there'd be a general election, and, you know, the CLP would sort of act as a sort of metaphor for the Labour Party at the time and what it represented, you know, politics from the cold face, if you like, and then going into the general election, you know. When I think back now, I was a bit naive, but the optimist in me thought, you know, it would be a document of winning, getting victory, and we would see what it meant to the people and communities, working class communities. It didn't happen. And then COVID happened the year after, so we carried on just filming and seeing how it affected the activists and communities. And then in the end, we thought, we're going to have to wrap it up somehow. So we decided, we had a date in the calendar, thought that'll be it now, the last bit of filming. But that was 3 years on, effectively. Yeah. There was 3 years between the first, just under 3 years from the first day of filming to the last.
Yeah. So tell people a little bit more about the Walton, the area, in terms of the constituency, because people might think of Walton who are maybe outside Liverpool or even in Merseyside and think, oh yeah, that's the park whereby Everton is, but constituencies are slightly different, aren't they? So what does it cover?
Yeah, so it's massive in many ways. It's not just Walton, it covers Anfield, yeah. Covers Everton, Norris Green,
yeah.
County Road, Club Moor, many places like that. It's the only constituency in the country that has two Premier League clubs within a sort of boundaries.
Yeah.
It's also the home of the safest Labour seat in the country, and has been for three general elections, whilst also, you know, it's all, after, you know, many years of austerity, there's many people struggling, and it's sort of, you know, it's a case in point for, you know, the struggle that working class communities are going through. So it's a melting pot of sort of life in many ways across the country. You know, you've got the sort of the football clubs worth billions, but then, you know, food banks operating in the shadows of these stadiums. So it's in many ways, that's why it was a perfect cocktail to make this film, because it says so much more than just about, you know, a community which I grew up in. It says more about sort of life and sort of activism and sort of why we need to should come together.
Yeah. You mentioned the food banks. Fan support and food banks feature heavily. I believe I've already seen the trailer, but sort of, you know, a part of the story. Ian Byrne, who's an MP now, not MP for Walton, there's obviously Dan Carden, but you know, is lives in the area, is sort of involved in that. So these characters who come, people will be aware of, who've followed us, and obviously Ian's been on the map quite a few times.
Yeah, I imagine there's a massive crossover. You know, Ian at the time, he weren't the MP, so we cover that in the film and sort of running for election. You know, there's like you don't even think about when you look back now, you know, a lot of the meetings that took place in Home Baked, if you like, and just on the streets. I imagine there'll be quite a bit of crossover, I think, that people will sort of recognise.
Yeah.
Definitely.
I mean, you mentioned that there's a lot of issues in Walton in terms of, you know, people struggling at the moment, and that's not just, well, I say at the moment, it's been a long time, but it's heightened, you know, there at the moment. But, you know, having seen your video on Liverpool 8, you know, I'm sure it's not, you know, when I see the full thing, there's positives, isn't there, around what communities and how people pull together when they're needed. And I thought that was prevalent in your documentary about Liverpool 8, and I'm sure it's prevalent in this one.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that's the thing about sort of working class communities. They're a microcosm for the best of humanity, you know what I mean? They can be sort of left behind, but then something starts to sort of ferment and grow again from the bottom, you know. You can get to this point where you're like, we're getting no help, we're getting no support, but from it, we can sort of look after each other and we can sort of build our own sort of infrastructure, if you like.
Yeah.
I think it's hard, but...
Sorry, that's my mouse.
Yeah, it's hard, but these sort of... these little beautiful things do happen from the sort of the bottom up, which do then show the positivity of, you know, we're not just sitting around moaning about the status quo. You know, we've got thoughts, we've got ideas, we've got creativity and passion, and that's what we'll do.
Yeah, absolutely. It's funny, isn't it, because you said there it's the safest Labour seats, but what we're seeing more and more of with this government, in my opinion, is that they'll ignore places that they feel have got no interest in them. And so it can be a negative almost, that is. And when we've seen, you know, how money is spent in this country, it's a scandal, really. There's certain areas, you know, that I'm sure, you know, look, every area's got places where you can spend money and it can make a difference, you know, I'm sure. But when you see, you know, places that have recently turned Conservative and the funding they've had compared to places like Walton, you know, it's almost 10 to 1.
Oh, goodness, yeah. So Liverpool is the city officially affected the most by austerity since the Conservative government got in 2010. That, you know, that's a fact. So, you know, in many ways, it's like it's class warfare, isn't it? You know, we have one idea, national government has another. You know, we are the enemy within, a statue would call us, if you like. But it, as you say, it goes two ways. It could be a badge of honour. That was sort of, you know, as you see with the booing of the national anthem, that with anti-establishment, I see it as a badge of honour. But then it can just mean sometimes we're marooned because national government won't help. And you can also say as well that, you know, did the Labour Party really care about Liverpool? Is it just a sort of, is it a safe haven for them?
Yeah.
So they don't put as much time and effort in as they should into other places, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Have you sensed that with locally, that there's actually, I mean, you were working with sort of the local Labour Party, but there's some frustration. People will be aware of the issues we've had at council level, and that might not be, you know, the responsibility, if you like, of MPs, but it all sort of, you know, filters through to people, doesn't it? And I've noticed, you know, in Kirkdale, for example, strong independent sort of standard at the moment. Is that something that you've noticed?
Yeah, I've definitely noticed. It's not so much in the film, if you like. Well, it's interesting because our film starts with sort of this idea of, like, you know, these group of socialists are sort of, we're not going to storm into Parliament, but, you know, we're going to win. And then come the end of the film, it like drops back down to sort of grassroots and how we can sort of improve our own communities, if you like. But yeah, there's a real disparity, isn't there, between sort of local politics and national politics and locally on the scene, it's as interesting as it is nationally, really, internally now, isn't it?
Yeah. What gives you sort of hope for the future? I know this is a big question there for a Monday, Dan, but, you know, you mentioned there, you know, we were all hopeful of that election. I feel like I've lost a lot of elections. I feel like that I'm losing a lot of arguments nationally. Not that I'm having loads, do you know what I mean? I'm not as involved as maybe I should be in certain things. But, you know, when you think about, you know, you mentioned there that Liverpool as a city, you know, generally speaking, positions itself in the opposite of what's going on nationally, and not just in terms of, you know, Tory Labour, you know, Liverpool voted Remain, for example. And so, you know, what gives you hope that things might change, or that we're able to initiate our own change within our communities?
What does give us hope? At some point, that change has got to come, really, hasn't it? It is heartbreaking when you lose these elections over and over, but I think in the grand scheme of things, you know, it could be the catalyst for change, because we can't keep carrying on as we are, the way the world's going.
Mm.
You know, it's just, you know, it's not feasible. What gives me real hope is, it is when you know, this film ultimately is about just people in one community who care about it and want to affect the community from the bottom up. And for me personally, it's a political film, but that's what politics is. You should sort of, that's where politics starts, really, of sort of, you know, caring about your neighbour, and then together you can sort of spread out as a community, you know, looking after each other and then building from there. And I think that's definitely still alive within communities, especially in, you know, in Toxteth when I made that film. It's definitely live in Toxteth, and I think it is across the city. In the film, Dan Carden, the MP, says, you know, what he hopes is that sort of he can take the lessons that Liverpool's from Liverpool, and you know, as a template to the rest of the country. You know, this idea of solidarity, of unity, of collectivism, you know, which, you know, I think as a wider city we do have, and we do have an identity of what's right and what's wrong in many ways. And I suppose that gives us hope. It's that, you know, it's still there, isn't it? It's that flame's flickering. It's quite dimly, but it's still flickering.
But also, you know, what you said about the idea of, you know, what you can do at a local level, almost being, because, you know, look, you know, so many of us want to change the world, but it can seem like, well, how do you start? Well, you sort of start by looking after people on your streets, or looking after the people, you know, maybe, you know, who aren't as fortunate as you or whatever. And, you know, there's so many people who say, oh, I'm not political, but then you see what they're doing, you're like, well, you are, really. You're just calling it something else.
Exactly. You know, there's a microcosm for politics on every street, you know, whether it be sort of an asylum seeker who's just moved in on the street, whether someone's just lost their jobs, you know, the cost of living going up. Every single household is sort of affected by politics. And I think that's not an argument anymore to say that politics doesn't affect you, or you keep politics out of anything. Really, politics is your life and affects it daily. I think the sooner we embrace it, the better, because then I think that's what we're, you know, change starts to happen once we realise that everything is political.
Yeah. So it's out in June. The trailer's available now. If people want to go on to YouTube and search for Manifesto, the trailer's on there now, but it'll be out. You know, this feature length in June. How are people going to be able to watch it?
Yeah, so we're having the premiere. The first screening, it'll be a fact on the 16th. There'll be a Q&A, so to confirm who's going to be on the panel. And it's doing a little tour of the country, actually. So it's going up to Glasgow, Newcastle, Leeds, Nottingham, and a few in London, really. So the little story of Walton's, you know, spreading out across the country.
Brilliant. Well, if you want to know more, if you go to the trailer, is it at SOTL_films in terms of Instagram and Twitter?
Yeah, that's it. At Sottle Films,
So it's just out the light. So at SOTL_films on Instagram and Twitter if you want to find out more. And, I mean, we didn't really talk about Almost Double Eight, but is that still around for people to watch as well?
Yeah. You can get that online. It's on DVD, on video demand. It's still doing the rounds.
Still knocking about. Dan, thanks so much for coming in. Really appreciate it. And, really looking forward to seeing the full thing.
Superb, thanks.
And it is John Gibbons for Tour Live, and as thousands of Scousers and, of course, Liverpool fans across the world plan to descend on Paris and France, we thought it'd be good to speak to someone very familiar with the city about what they could maybe expect, and maybe a few tips and also a bit of excitement as well. So I've got Camille on from the official supporters club in France. Thank you so much for joining us on the Anfield Wrap.
No, thank you for having me. It's great.
So, first of all, normally, obviously, there's a big build-up to a Champions League final in a host city. This time, it was a little bit strange. It was meant to be in Moscow and then late move. So, I guess for the supporters club there, it was, this is really exciting, but suddenly we might have a lot of work to do very quickly.
Yeah, I think the hardest thing was just, as soon as it was announced, is how are we going to manage? Because our pubs, where we gather and watch, are tiny. And we can host 100 people, maybe max. And I think our first thought is, how are we going to deal with that? How are we going to, we need to start talking to the authority, trying to get the, to see if we can, they can get extra space. But no, it's super exciting because I remember the last final where, I don't live in Paris anymore, but the last final in Paris was 2006 when I lived there. And it was just after Istanbul. And I remember hoping that we were going to be in the final, seeing all the sign about the Champions League final, and then we didn't make it. So it's now, it's just slightly surreal to think that Liverpool is coming to my hometown and we're going to be able to host everyone and start to welcoming people. Some people are in the pub already on Sunday, arrived for the whole week to spend in Paris. And there's people coming in every day into our pubs. We got bombarded with messages from people from Liverpool, but also all the other supporters club from all over the world that I've been speaking to for a few years now. So it's just super exciting. I really can't wait to be Friday where we can actually see people and party together and enjoy those moments, and then just be able to enjoy Saturday as well together. So yeah, very exciting.
Absolutely. Are you guys putting out, you know, tips for people on, because you mentioned, you know, you have a few bars and stuff. So if people go on to your social media, is there information there on where people can maybe gather on, you know, if they're around Thursday or Friday night and they want to be around other Liverpool fans and don't want to spend €15 on a pint of beer, where they can go?
We have. I think it went, some of them went on last night, and there's more that going to come up in the next few days. The teams are working hard in trying to make nice visual. We had a very complex document and trying to make it more readable for everyone. So all on all our social, there's wonderful, Leah and the team has done a wonderful job in making it very easy to see, and very important information not to forget is there's work on the RER, so the train that takes you from Paris to the airport on Sunday, there's no train.
Okay, that is important.
That is very important. And I just
I'm glad you got you on just for that, to be honest with you.
So people, basically, there is, so you get the train to the Stade de France and then you'll have to get a bus. So we've got an image explaining what to do. But I think just people will hopefully be very hungover because we'll be celebrating all night.
Or maybe even still up.
Still up. But we'll have to just to remember it will take a lot longer to get to Charles de Gaulle Airport and to Orly. But Orly got buses that you can take from central Paris. So it's slightly different. But for Charles de Gaulle, it will be a big thing not to forget. There is no train. And from what I've just heard, Thursday, it seems that on Thursday, there may be no train either. So if people are arriving on Thursday, they need to just be prepared that it might be slightly longer to get into your pub. But luckily, our pubs are all near the north of Paris. So I know quite a lot of people have kept and stayed all around the north of Paris. Our pubs are there. The team are going to be around to help out as well to make sure communication. But yeah, please go and see the pubs, not for the match because it's too small. And I know there's been announcements of saying we could go. The team didn't get the authorization to extend and have more space because we have to rely on the authority. So just for that, please don't go. Try to go to the pubs to watch the game because it'll be only reserved for regulars and people from the OLSE that we want, if they want to be there. So that's my only advice. But there's plenty of bars. The good thing about Paris is my advice is please don't go to just go to the Irish pubs. I know it's great. There's a lot. But if you want to experience, there's plenty of small bistro in Paris where you go in and instead of drinking a pint, maybe just get a bottle of wine for €20 and it's actually nice wine. it tastes nice. You can experience just sitting on a terrace in Paris. It's still my favorite thing to do every time I go back home is just go in and find a nice bistro and just sit out look at people and drink wine. And it's just a wonderful, leave the Parisian experience more than just going, the pubs are amazing. You'll still have plenty of supporters all around. But for one of my favorite parts is if you go to near Saint-Michel, so in the very old part of Paris, and you literally get lost in all the small streets. There's so many bars and restaurants open. We've just sitting up and drinking wine. I think my advice will be, and my English husband said that, it's cheaper and better to drink wine in France and Paris especially than beers, because you'll have not very good beers at very expensive price. So switch to wine just for the weekend and feel more Parisian that way.
There we are. Well, if it makes you feel to feel more Parisian, I'll do it. Do you know what I mean?
There you go.
I mean, obviously the question that I've been asked 1,000 times, that you will have been asked about this 1,000 times, is all about the fan park. Where is there a fan park? Where is the fan park? When are they announcing the fan park? We are recording this Wednesday morning. It is now 11:02. We gather at 11 o'clock. There will be an announcement.
The announcement's been pushed back.
Oh, the announcement's been pushed back, but there we are. we're expecting something to be announced.
Something
today.
To come. We can confirm that there is a fan park.
Yeah.
So that's confirmed. There is a fan park. And a fun fact is, and it's very weird for me, the fan park is just by my high school, so where I went to high school. And I used to go wearing my Liverpool scarf going up to high school. So it's very surreal for me, and it's going to be very weird to go to Cours de Vincennes. So you have to get we have a tile on our social media explaining which stops, which station, which area, which metro you need to get to the fan park. But there will be a fan park open from 2:00. And then we don't know exactly when it's closing. But there's a fan park and it's just by my high school. And I found it so surreal that I'm going to be surrounded by Liverpool fan in a place where I used just to walk and people laugh at me with my wearing my Liverpool scarf going to school. But, you know, it's life shows you some very strange way that what is meant to be would be. So it's great.
Absolutely, absolutely. What a funny thing to have happened, and what a funny sort of change around that is. So it has to be said that a lot of people have done a lot of really hard work to make this fan park happen.
Yes.
And I understand why Liverpool supporters have been a little bit frustrated that they haven't had some information earlier. And listen, I would have loved to have known what was going on earlier. I haven't been involved in the organisations at all. We've just been making inquiries because we want the party ourselves and we want to be involved. But, you know, me and you both know, Camilla, just how hard a lot of people have worked to get this on, and it's not easy. You know, you're shutting down a large area of a capital city with very little notice to accommodate a number of supporters that, if it would have been another club who got to this Champions League final, it wouldn't have been an issue. Do you know what I mean? And so it's a unique set of circumstances that Paris has had to deal with, really.
And Paris has Roland Garros as well. So there's the tennis on the other side of the city. So I know people will think it's very far where they chose to, but I think in terms of crowd management, having people on the other side, when there is a big tennis tournament on closer to the Eiffel Tower side, I think that's probably one of the reasons they picked that, and I know for sure that there have been so many meetings. Again, we're not involved. We've just been told because people know people, and they always, there's been a lot of meetings trying to get that happening. So the fact that we have a fan park already is amazing, because at first what we were told that there was none, and it was just going to be a few things by the Hôtel de Ville, so by the City Hall, and that was it. And it's quite a small square, so it wouldn't have hosted all the Liverpool fans wanted to gather together and party. So having a fan park is going to be amazing. The burning question is, will the game be shown at the fan park? My question is, we're waiting for the club to, are making inquiries. Everyone's pushing for it. Hopefully we'll have some good news very soon, but there's nothing we can confirm, neither the supporters club nor, I'm sure, the Anfield rep, until things are official, but there's a big push trying to show it. But if not, not to worry. As I said, there's not just pubs with big venues to watch that will be showcasing the match. The match is on normal TV in France. It will be shown in all the bars and bistro all around Paris. So if people are coming with kids and don't really want to experience the fun park a bit, but not feel too, feel a bit overwhelmed with the kids. There'll be plenty of places. Yeah, I know a lot of people have booked areas of bars, but there's also a lot of places that will not take booking, but will accommodate because it's great for the business. So they will adapt. Don't worry about that. I'm pretty sure. So
as I say, this is Wednesday at 11 a.m. So just keep an eye on social media, because by the time you listen to this, there might be an announcement and things like that. And so let's all hope so. But you know, whatever happens in terms of, you know, the fan park and even the game, you know, itself, it must be so exciting for all of you who work so hard on these supporters clubs, and that's all around the world. You know, we've got to know quite a few of the supporters clubs over the years, and it's been really nice. But you guys who are taking numbers every week and getting people into bars and arranging all these things to make give people the best experience possible supporting Liverpool, to have everyone come to you for the party is you know, you guys must be buzzing. I don't know, Rodo, I've had loads of conversations with him, and he's doing so much to make sure everyone enjoys it. So it's a lot of work, but I'm sure a lot of fun too.
Yes, it is. And it's, you know, one thing I think every supporters club all around the world will say, when you join the supporters club, then you realize you're joining the Liverpool family. And when you go to Liverpool, you, wherever you go in the world, you can meet Liverpool fans who share the same love and passion for the club. And that's one of the, for us to be able to showcase that we've got members from all over France. We're not just Paris, but are traveling. There's one of them had a baby 5 months ago, and it's the first night she's going to be without her baby, just because she wants to be part of that experience of welcoming it and trying to live those moments that we've seen in Kiev where people were not able to go. A lot of people did travel to Madrid and experienced the atmosphere there, and just can't wait to have everyone in France. And just, you know, you start seeing in public transports some Liverpool fan coming in all through this week. We're probably going to see more and more. And for us, that's just, it's just amazing, you know. So don't be scared if you get some random people starting to chat to you, because or be giving you a big smile when Parisian don't give a big smile. It's just because we're a fellow Liverpool fan that I've just made up for you here. So.
Well, I can't wait to see you. I can't wait to see everyone else. And I can't wait to get over. Our bus leaves at 11 o'clock. We'll be in Paris by 1 o'clock on Thursday. And I'll hopefully have a glass of white wine in my hand by 3 o'clock. But thank you so much. Thanks for coming up. If you just, before you go, let everyone know how to find you guys on Twitter and Facebook and whatever else you post.
It's OLSC France on Instagram. Twitter is Liverpool France. So if you just look at them, you'll find us. And then, please get in touch. We're getting a lot of inquiries. We all volunteer. We all have day jobs as well and trying to help out. So bear with us because there's a lot of requests. But if you have something specific or any question, please just get in touch and we're doing our best to reply to everyone.
All right. Take care of yourself and see you in France.
Yes, see you in France.
And we are back to talk about the Champions League final. The Champions League final, Adam Smith. It's remarkable. It's 3 and 5 years. We'll get on to talk about them, Real Madrid, in a minute or two, and their journey to get here, which has certainly, I think, been much more spectacular than ours. It's actually been, if I say relatively straightforward, this isn't me acting as though it's been easy for Liverpool. The group looked nightmarish. They then dealt very, very neatly with Inter Milan, indeed. But ultimately, Liverpool have got to this final. You've been able to see the run of it. And as far as I'm concerned, you know, they walk into it knowing that this competition is a competition that they're now built for beautifully.
Yeah, I think I thought it was really interesting. I was listening to the most recent Midnight Caller with Rory just this morning, actually, and he said something like, in his head, he doesn't think Real Madrid losing 2-0 to Liverpool is how their story ends, which I thought was totally fair. But at the same time, I thought, but I don't think us losing to Real Madrid is how our story ends for this season. Like, we've been in the Champions League, Liverpool have been relentless. We lost I think we lost one game, didn't we? And it was not a dead rubber, but we lost it in a way that meant it was irrelevant.
Yeah, Inter Milan.
Yeah, so it was sort of, we lost. That's frustrating, but it didn't matter. Like, it didn't matter. And even if they had somehow taken it to extra time, I still would have thought that we'd have just beaten them. So, you know, it's been an unbelievable campaign from the players who are just sort of got, they just, it just feels a little bit like they've gone, well, last season, we got knocked out by Real Madrid at their training ground. It was offensive the way in which we got knocked out of this last season. Let's make up for it this time, and we'll just absolutely blow everyone away. And that's what they've done. They've just been better than everyone. There's been no point really in which I've thought I just don't fancy us here. Even in the semi final, where obviously things were looking a little bit harum scarum, I still was like, but this. These lads just know what they're doing. They just know what they're doing, and this manager won't stand for it. And that's what I think is going to happen in the Champions League final. They're just not going to stand for it.
Ian, they've come through the journey that they've come through, Liverpool, I mean, and we now come into this one. And when the two finals, I mean that they've got to the Champions League final, we're getting to two domestic cup finals. They've got to the Champions League final whilst taking the league right the way through until the last day, whilst breaking 90 points in the league. It's the second time Liverpool have broken 90 points in the league and made it to a Champions League final. The level of excellence that demonstrates, I think, is phenomenal. The level of consistency it demonstrates is phenomenal. The key thing for them is to keep that excellence and that consistency up. That's what they're going to have to work on. I think the one thing that I took from my conversation with Rory on Midnight Caller was, I think Liverpool need this game to be a very sane one. The more sanity there is within this football match, the likelier Liverpool are to prevail.
I would agree with that. I also think it's a bit mad how all of a sudden there's a narrative flying around that, you know, breaking 90 points is nothing to be kind of proud of, if it means you don't win anything. When actually, what it demonstrates is exactly what you just said. It demonstrates excellence, and it demonstrates a consistency that is matched by so few others in terms of going 38 games and being able to break 90 points. That is something to be massively proud of, whether it ends with a trophy or not. And obviously you want it to end with a trophy, and that's what history will remember, the people who win the trophies. But you can't talk about Liverpool breaking 90 points as in it's just the norm, because it isn't the norm. And when you do it alongside picking up two domestic trophies and then reaching a Champions League final, it's an unbelievable performance from this Liverpool team and the manager and the players and all the backroom staff. It's one hell of a collective performance. And I think you're right about the game. You don't want it to be insane. I think, you know, that's very much Liverpool of maybe 4 or 5 years ago. You know, when the manager first comes into the club and you've got those 2 or 3 years where games can be a little bit topsy-turvy and there is that chaos that sits in the heart of some of those football matches. You don't want it to be like that. And Real Madrid, you can almost describe it as they fed off some of that chaos. You know, you think about PSG, you think about Chelsea, you think about Man City. There's elements of chaos throughout all of those games. And Real Madrid can probably count themselves a little bit fortunate that they've got to where they are. But listen, that's what sometimes big football clubs with a history in this competition do. We've done it ourselves. You have to ride it sometimes.
Yeah,
and they have got a special relationship with this tournament, as have we. You know, they're going for number 14. So you don't want it to be insane. You want Liverpool to demonstrate control, Neil, and I fully believe they will do.
Talk about them, Emma. They're going for number 14, as Ian says. For some of those players, it's number 5. What was interesting in the semi-final, looking back on it now, the game against Manchester City, the second leg, is that Casemiro, Modric and Cruz, all of whom are part of going for the 5th one in their careers, Real Madrid's 14th. Those footballers are the ones who get subbed in extra time. None of the three of those midfielders finished the game. They've been incredible, incredible careers, but also incredible in this run at times. All three of the players that I've just described there, especially Modric from when I've caught him, Casemiro remains terrific at what he does. But there is a thing there, isn't there? These are footballers who, this is a massive game and they'll all find a way to go to the well one more time, don't get me wrong. But these footballers have all been around shipping 4 goals over the course of a game to Manchester City. They've all been around feeling the game sort of wash away from them. Alaba, another footballer in his 30s with a ton of experience. They've lived this season. They've picked a lot of balls out of a lot of nets in this competition, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, like 100%. And by the way, just before I answer, I just want to say, like, this is the Champions League final. It's Real Madrid, it's Liverpool, two of the biggest clubs in the world. Like, I'm so excited. I'm so excited. Just want to say that, because this is what the Champions League final is. This is, you know, this is it, the ultimate.
It's the one it should be.
Oh, 100%. But yeah, look, these players, you're right, they have picked the ball out of the net. They've had to go through those big moments. And actually, I think out of everyone, it's probably the younger players which seem to have dragged them over the line a little bit in recent times. You know, you look at the knockout stages and the likes of, you know, Camavinga, Vinicius, Rodrigo. You know, they've been players that have really stood out. Obviously, Benzema, with the exception, he's one of those that's going for a fifth with Real Madrid. But it's actually, I think it's the younger players which really have pulled them over the line. I think that the key for Liverpool is recognising that, yes, they've got those big players, the Modrics, that have got those moments of quality. But that's why you make it a game which is sane. You take away the ability for them to turn it into chaos by producing those one moments, those two moments. Because, you know, a side like Liverpool, they're the ones who have moments in the Champions League. It's Liverpool's thing. So, you know, if you take that scenario out of it and just play, you know, the best football, then Liverpool are the best football team out there. You know, I don't think anyone can deny it, that out of everyone left in the competition, Liverpool are the best side. So if they play their game, then these big players, you know, those moments won't come.
Issam Kayasi is correcting me, which is absolutely fine. I hasten to add, Cruz and Casemiro weren't involved in 2014. Of course they weren't. Very, very valid points indeed. Real Madrid have conceded, and I'll say it again, they've conceded 4 to Manchester City in a one-off game, 3 to Chelsea in a one-off game. That second Chelsea game was also in Real Madrid's own ground. Worth pointing that out as well. Paris Saint-Germain should have done better against them over the course of the competition. I'll come back to you on it, Emma. There's a lot of focus. There's been a good piece written by Michael Cox for The Athletic around the battle between Vinicius and Trent Alexander-Arnold. There are always pieces to be written about a battle between an attacking player and Trent Alexander-Arnold. For me, if I'm looking at this game, if there's an area I'm looking at, I'm looking at Real Madrid's right back. I'm looking at Carvajal up against Diaz. I'm looking at the fact that there's a reason why they've shipped 3 to Chelsea, a reason why they shipped 4 to Manchester City in one-off games. And one of those reasons for me is that I'm not convinced by either centre-half of the 3 options that he's got. I'm not convinced as centre-halves. I'm not convinced by the right-back, and the left-back looks like a good player, but I'm not entirely convinced by the right-back, never have been, but also he is now getting on and he's played a hell of a lot of football in his career. There will always be focus pieces, will always be written in England, focusing on Liverpool and framing Liverpool's weaknesses first. But for me, Real Madrid's weaknesses, those that hang there across that back line, they are the ones that Liverpool should be focused on.
Yeah, and the midfielders that you mentioned before, the ones that have, you know, that are aging a little bit, because they're the ones providing that protection for that back four. And you could argue that, yes, their qualities lie, Casemiro probably an exception, but their qualities lie in those moments of quality at the other end. So, yeah, I think there's definitely ways to get at Real Madrid. And I think it's interesting when people make up these comparisons of, yeah, like you say, you know, Trent against whoever it is. Liverpool don't defend as a back four. They never have, and they never will do under Jurgen Klopp. You know, that's very, I don't know, 2014, 2013. They defend from the front. And actually, you know, everyone knows that Liverpool's press is so important. If they get the press right, which is why I think Roberto Firmino might start, by the way. If they get that press right, they don't need to worry about, you know, the likes of Vinicius against Trent, because there should never be a scenario, if all goes to plan, where it's Trent against Vinicius. That's not the way that Liverpool play. And I think that's perhaps the difference, is that actually with Real Madrid, yes, you know, they're not the same. They're not, you know, just a pure back four or back three, whatever they choose to line up on the night. They are a bit more man on man as to what Liverpool might be. And I think that is down to the fact that they haven't got midfielders who can press relentlessly from, you know, 90, 120 minutes, whatever it is, because they haven't got 3 box-to-box midfielders. You look at, yes, I know Fabinho and Thiago are obviously going to be doubts for the final, but if you look at Fabinho, Thiago and Henderson ordinarily for Liverpool, all 3 of them have got the ability to play box-to-box if needs be. So if the game does turn into chaos, you know, they can do that, and they can provide that extra cover for Liverpool's back four, which Real Madrid probably don't have. So, I think if Liverpool get their press right and they get it right from the front, there's just no way, in my eyes, I can see Real Madrid being able to get in at Liverpool's back four. So, yeah, I think get Bobby Firmino pressing from the front, and I think it'll be really interesting to see how they cope with that.
The importance of Liverpool turning them round, Ian, but the other thing is take the chances. It's a very, very strange thing to say. You know, City score 5 against them across the 2 games, and they arguably could do with being a bit more clinical. It shouldn't work like that. That's where it'll end up for this Liverpool side. You know, they've got to take the chances, because I think that there's every chance they create a number of them, and even that they create a number of them quite early in the game.
Yeah, I think that's spot on, Neil. I think, you know, given what we've seen at Real Madrid this season, even if you are out in front, there is that element of they could do something spectacular. And I think you've got to put them to bed when those chances do arise. And I think the other thing is, and this is something City didn't really do, when you are in front, game intelligence. You've got to take those moments where, and it might be that you go down and just grab a couple of minutes and take the sting out of things if that tide does suddenly turn to 10 or 15 minutes. Because let's be honest, Liverpool are a better team, but we can't sit here and say that Real Madrid have got no chance. They've
got a massive chance. They've got a massive chance, Ian.
They're steeped in history, which means something in this competition. But when you couple that with quality, and they have got quality, and I do take the points around, you know, there's some aging legs in the middle of the park, and whether it's 4-2-3-1 for Real Madrid or whether it's more of a 4-3-3, you can shift it depending on how you want to kind of, you know, put the players on a kind of piece of paper when you're lining them up, so to speak. They've got quality, and they've got quality from the bench. So you see that when Camavinga comes on against Man City, and all of a sudden there's pace and there's legs. And
he'll want to play as well.
Absolutely. So if you are tiring and it does start to go the distance, they have got those players from the bench who can stretch you and cause you problems. I think that's why it's really important. And of course, before we started this show, that Fabinho's training today and he's taking part in a small-sided game, that's massive. Because without Thiago, you are looking at the balance of Liverpool's midfield without those two players, and just saying, I don't know, you know, I'm not quite convinced all the players you would play, and you imagine it would have been Henderson, Keita and Milner if Thiago and Fabinho weren't available. And Thiago does look unlikely now. But whilst they're all good players, I'm not convinced that's a great balance in terms of the midfield. And whilst James Milner is and has been a phenomenal footballer for this club, I don't particularly want to see him starting Champions League finals at 36. And yes, I know Modric is 36 and he'll probably be starting one, but there are two very different players that play in different systems. So it's important Fabinho plays, because I think that does give us the right balance. And I think even without Thiago, Keita coming in with Henderson, that feels okay to me. But yeah, Neil, they've got to put them to the sword when those opportunities arise. And they've got the players to do it. And I take Emma's point about Firmino, but I wouldn't be starting him. He hasn't really looked fit to me since he's come back. You know, you see his cameo the other day, and he's struggling to find the shirt, to be honest. And listen, he'll train this week and all that, I get it. But I'd be starting Salah, Mane and Luis Diaz. For me, there's no debate on the front three, as far as I'm concerned. No, others will have a different view, but that's what I'd be going with. And then, you know, the back four, well, for me, it's Joel Matip alongside Virgil van Dijk. I think experience is everything in some of these football matches. So, yeah, that's what I'd be doing.
Adam, Thiago is not ruled out by the manager today. He's had the opportunity to rule him out. He's chosen not to. He says that he's got a chance. He's currently in the gym, according to Neil Jones, doing some work with the physio at the training facility there from a Liverpool point of view. Fabinho was saying he will be ready. He will be back for us in this one. I think the manager does have questions, and I think that those questions he will be, I think, going into them in more depth than you think. Emma's Firmino suggestion, that I think the manager will be thinking long and hard about it, but I'd sort of agree in the final analysis he may well back Ian. I think not so much around the idea of what he wants from the left-hand side, but more because I think he'll be absolutely desperate to keep Mane on the pitch at number 9. Like, I think that you'll feel that's his way home. I think at the minute, Mane, you know, the best finisher in world football at the moment, at the very highest level, looks as though it's one of Mane, Son and Benzema in terms of where everyone's currently at in front of goal. I'd love Mohamed Salah to prove me wrong on Saturday and give it the big one. But, you know, off the last sort of 3 months or so, you would say those three have been the defining sort of finishers of most of the football. Oh, and Lewandowski, obviously, of all the football that you've caught, they've been the ones that have absolutely stuck out. I think he'll be desperate to have Sadio Mane play through the middle of the pitch.
Yeah, and I don't see a world in which that doesn't happen unless he's injured, to be honest. I think there are loads of question marks that he'll have. But I do think that Salah and Mane will be pretty much nailed on. Obviously, the goalkeeper will be nailed on. Van Dijk will be nailed on, provided he's fit, which we assume he is because he was on the bench. I think Mane in particular is one where the manager won't have any messing around, because he's just adapted so brilliantly to that role, and just, you know, he knows what he's doing, and I think it's. I think the Firmino one's really interesting because I thought he looked great against Southampton. I thought I was like, oh hello, this is really Firmino at his best here. He looks so bright, pressing all the time, passing brilliantly, and then he absolutely was awful when he came on the other day against Wolves. But when he was on the pitch, we scored. So you know, there's always that kind of debate, isn't there, around it? Because he is the player that just offers you so much more than goal scoring and passing and that sort of thing, you know, and the pressing is important. And I think one of the key things will be that our back line needs to be on it, because the likes of Vinicius terrify me in terms of his pace. And if they can get that ball behind the back line right, then that's where they'll cause us problems. But one area I don't think the manager will be spending more than 5 seconds thinking about is whether Sadio Mane starts up front. I just think it's locked in.
On Emma, the idea of who does it centre-half, Ian went for Matip before. I felt that that was a closer conversation before Sunday. I think Konaté didn't look what he has looked in the past. I think Jimenez does a really good job against him. But the thing to point out is he doesn't have Virgil van Dijk there as well. It felt like the two of them could even have done with the opposite challenge over the course of the game. Which one do you think he'll do?
Yeah, for me, it's a no-brainer. I'd start Matip. And that's just because I think he's had a little bit more time with van Dijk to work on that high line. And yeah, I completely agree with Adam. I think Vinicius and, you know, even Rodrigo, their pace, I'd be concerned about that. So I'd want to make sure that defence is properly organised. And, you know, I think Konaté has made massive strides, certainly in the second half of the season. But yeah, I just feel a little bit more comfortable with Matip and Van Dijk. I just think they're a bit better rehearsed in that. And by the way, Van Dijk, I'm pretty sure he is 100% fit. But even if he's not, I don't care if he's 60% fit, he starts for me. It's an absolute no-brainer.
Adam, are you also very much in Matip's corner on this?
I would have said Konaté before the game against Wolves. I agree with you that he was terrorised. But again, the only thing I think is that his recovery pace is better than Matip's, and that might be important. So that's, I think the manager really will be going, oh, I don't know. But to be honest, whichever back four I see, I'm not going to be going, oh my God, what's he picked that for? Like that's what they've done. You know, if you can compare and contrast to last season where, like, you know, one of us could have got a start, I think he's really got to the point where he's like, these lads are brilliant and I'm fine with any of them. And that's, you know, as long as Van Dijk's there, I should add as the caveat. That's the key one for me. As long as Van Dijk's there, I'll be absolutely fine whoever the manager picks. But I think I might lean towards Konaté because of the recovery pace.
I think there's no real bad kind of outcome here. I think, you know, you can look at that game against Wolves and it wasn't Konaté's kind of finest performance, I think it's fair to say. I think Matip at times as well looked a little bit shaky in that game. And I think Wolves do cause Liverpool one or two problems. But I think over the course of his career so far, Konaté has been pretty outstanding, I think it's fair to say. And what he does offer, and I know Joel's popped up with a goal here and there as well, but he does offer that aerial threat as well. So I think there's maybe a little bit of trade-off there. If you do see Konaté start, yes, he brings the pace as well, and that could be important. But also that aerial threat from Liverpool's own set pieces is absolutely massive, and it has been this season already. So if it ends up being Konaté, I don't think anyone's sitting there thinking, oh my God, because he's already proven this season. He looks like one hell of an addition. I just lean towards Matip because of the experience. And I think in Champions League finals, sometimes that can mean an awful lot. It could be the difference sometimes. So that's where I'd go.
Emma's excited, very excited indeed. It's going to be fabulous on Saturday night, Emma. It's a wonderful end to what's been a brilliant season. Are Liverpool going to win?
I think so. I can't see them not picking up one of the big two trophies. And obviously, you know, with the Premier League going, I think the players will be not devastated to lose that at all. Actually, I think it'll be the opposite. I think they'll be so spurred on to go and win this Champions League. I just can't see Liverpool not winning it. But as we've said, you look, it's not going to be easy. And I think it's going to be a horrible watch for every single Liverpool fan out there. I genuinely think it will be. But yeah, Liverpool's win for me.
Adam?
Yeah, I think the one thing that concerns me a little bit is Real Madrid's record against us under the manager. But I think as we saw with United, it sort of gets to the point where the manager goes, all right, I get how to do this now. And then once he's figured it out, he's just figured it out. And so I think... Real Madrid are brilliant, and I will definitely, you know, if I were to place a bet, I'd definitely be going for both teams to score. But I think we're going to score more than them, and I think that we're going to do it in a way that means that we all get to celebrate them on Sunday at the parade. The one thing I will say, I want to be on record as saying on this here esteemed podcast, is to say that even if we don't, this has still been a phenomenal season for Liverpool. And the idea that, you know, because we didn't win the quadruple, a double should somehow be laughed at or mocked is ludicrous. Liverpool are a phenomenal football team. They've shown that this season. And I think they're going to win a treble to prove it.
Ian?
I think they'll do it. I think it'll end up being 3-1 or something like that. I can see, you know, maybe two clear goals in it for Liverpool, but I do think there'll be times in the game where it maybe does get a little bit uncomfortable. But I said after the game at the weekend, I think they'll use some of that hurt. And there's no doubt, you could tell there was a number of players there which were struggling with it. And obviously, you know, there was a chance to do something absolutely spectacular, never been kind of done before. But as Adam said, to go and do a treble, to go win three cups is just, it'll still go down and it will be one of the greatest seasons in the club's history. If you win a European Cup, that is one of the greatest seasons in your club's history. If you go and add another two trophies as well, which they've done with the domestic cups, then, my God, we are talking about one hell of a season. And I think just because you've been hurt at the weekend does not give you the divine right to then go win the big one the week after. But I do think they'll use it. I do think it is arguably the most hungriest group of players I've ever seen play for the football club. They look incredibly focused. They look incredibly hungry. That's very much coming from the manager. You can see it in his kind of tone, I suppose, after the game at the weekend. He was devastated, of course he was, but doesn't really show that too much. It's all about what comes next. And what comes next is a huge challenge, but it's one I think they're capable of doing. So, yeah, 3-1 to Liverpool.
We are privileged to get this many Champions Leagues in a 5-year spell, to get this many Champions League finals in a lifetime. There are supporters, the vast majority of football supporters, will never see their team play one Champions League final. The City of Manchester has barely seen Manchester play a Champions League final. The City of London has barely seen London play a Champions League final. Liverpool are 3 in 5 years. This will be their 10th through the existence of the football club. It has been a pleasure today with Adam Smith, with Ian Ryan, with Emma Sanders. Champions League final finals do not come along very often at all. Enjoy the journey with the Anfield app. Download the app, get stuck into all the bits and pieces. But whatever you're doing over the weekend, whatever you're doing on Saturday, you make sure it's special.
Sports Social Podcast Network.